Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Hiawatha. My name is Chris. I'm one of the pastors here. Welcome again if you're brand new to our church. Like Leo was saying, we're always glad to have visitors. So thank you for checking out our church and welcome again. We are in a series, kind of wrapping up a series in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, the Old Testament books that kind of talk about and highlight the rise of the kings in Israel's history. We only have 4 weeks left, including today, and this has been like a 8+ month series, so we're drawing to a close here. Still lots of great texts and themes to uncover, though, in the month of May here. But if I were to try to summarize this book, if you're brand new to this genre maybe, or it's just been a while since you've read this, or also kind of catch you up to speed on where we've been in kind of the immediate sort of literary context here, I would just say that the books primarily have to do with a man named David. There's a lot of characters. There's a lot of kind of A-level characters, so I don't want to skip over that, but David's probably the most important person to know, not just because of his prominence in this book, but his prominence in all of the Bible, even in the New Testament, where you see Jesus called the Son of David, and so linking himself genealogically and theologically with him. That's actually a big part of every sermon we've been talking about with David, but a big part of later today as well. But I would just say that David's ups and downs, just as a human being, as a sinner, who has highs and lows like we all do, and yet God is stubbornly making promises to him still, stubbornly loving him and being faithful to him, even though there's consequences for sin and darkness, and he's feeling the weight of that and all around him in his life and the world. That becomes, I think, for us ahead of time then, as we read the Bible, maybe, not that we have to, but if we read it cover to cover, ahead of time it expresses the true nature of Christian salvation. And we see our story in that. And it also expresses the particular story of Jesus Christ, who had come 1,000 years later to become this final finish line, so to speak, of David, who would become the son of David, who would come in David's line to fulfill all of David's experiences, the good and the bad. So to fulfill them and kind of wrap the good things that, David did around himself and say, I'm going to take this to the next level and fulfill it and be even a better version of it. But also to solve the bad things, to be kind of a period to the question mark of the Old Testament, to kind of reverse things as well that are problematic and that are maybe keeping us from God and are judgment-oriented. So to absorb the good, again, but also in sometimes in other ways to pass up certain things as the better word, Jesus being that better word as well. So comparison and contrast then, in other words, we've been seeing. So lots more to say, but I'll just kind of offer that up as a little bit of a, both kind of an encapsulation of where we've been and kind of are, but also how we're trying to interpret this book, following Scripture's lead itself. So we're in chapter 18 today. If you want to turn to a Bible, feel free to do that. If you want to kind of see this in broader context or read in something in front of you, that's great. This will be on screen, though, too. Absalom's abnormal death is the focus today. I'll explain more of that in a minute. But to summarize kind of the first 8 verses of this chapter, David is still in exile. His son Absalom had staged a coup against him and is now chasing him down to try to find him and kill him per the advice of some of his advisors. But David had people loyal to him serving as spies and informants under Absalom. That's kind of a big part of this as well, which we are kind of skipping over. But they send word to David about Absalom's plans, and in turn, David devises this plan himself to march out and surprise him and bring the fight to him. David's final instructions, though, this is important, were to spare Absalom, his son, even though at this time he was his arch enemy. Even kind of as an aside to that, maybe you've already felt this, but just feel again the tragedy that this is, that you have a father and a son who are like, the son wants to kill his dad. And the breakdown of this relationship, I mean, we can kind of empathize, maybe we can't fully. We're all in different spots, but I just mean, like, this is tragedy. This is an awful story that God writes into the pages of his book to teach us about how far down he's going to come to get us. And again, we'll come to that in just a little bit. But I think David here, his instructions to spare Absalom is kind of cool, and there's mercy to it. And even though, again, Absalom's the principal antagonist right now. All right, third thing then, during the battle, David's troops are winning decisively when something really strange and tragic happens to Absalom that leads to his demise. And we'll pick up in verse 9 and read what that is. Verse 9, now Absalom happened to meet David's men. He was riding his mule, and as the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, Absalom's hair got caught in the tree, and he was left hanging in midair while the mule he was riding kept on going. When one of the men saw what had happened, he told Joab, I just saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree. Joab said to the men who had told him this, wait, you saw him? Why didn't you strike him to the ground right there? Then I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a warrior's belt. But the man replied, even if 1,000 shekels were weighed out into my hands, I would not lay a hand on the king's son. In our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, protect the young man Absalom for my sake. And if I had put my life in jeopardy and nothing is hidden from the king, you would have kept your distance from me. Joab said, I'm not going to wait for you like this. So he took 3 javelins in his hand and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still alive in the oak tree. They took Absalom and threw him into a big pit in the forest and piled up a large heap of rocks over him. Meanwhile, all the Israelites fled to their homes. During his lifetime, Absalom had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley as a monument to himself, for he thought, I have no son to carry on the memory of my name. He named the pillar after himself, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. Okay, so before we get to the circumstances and strange details surrounding the way Absalom died, there's a lot of strangeness to this. I said first service, the abnormality, I think, is the key. Probably most of us didn't walk in the room kind of fearing, like, am I going to die with my hair stuck in a tree someday? You know, like the circumstances are very strange and unique. And as I'll say later, I think that kind of makes the whole thing ripe for theology and for our focus. I'll get to that. But before we get to all of that, which is the main part of this passage, I don't want to skim over just how tragic Absalom's story is. This is like, we're kind of closing the book on Absalom, one of David's sons here, obviously, because this is the story of his death, and so he's not going to continue in the story. And so I just want to focus on him for a second. I mean, if he had a tombstone, it would probably say, he died a horrible death after a horrible life. Absalom, David's son. Like, it's that bad. This whole thing, if you remember, got in motion when his half-brother Amnon raped his sister Tamar, and he got infuriated by that, and then he killed his brother for doing so, and then he sends himself into exile because he's afraid of what his dad David is going to do to him, and never fully reconciled with him. That's a whole other layer that's tragic. Then his heart turns bitter, and he starts to blame his father. He steals the throne, as I was saying before, away from him. That whole coup attempt happens, and it's successful. Then you have this, in verse 18, this really sad verse at the end about him that's kind of summative of his life, because again, this is like we're closing the book on Absalom. It's sort of summative, where it says, and by the way, after his death account, he set up a monument for himself, and he named it after himself, because he had no son to carry on his name. And then if you read that in reverse, of course, then he dies after that, and the book is closed. So that's really, like, from what we know in the Bible, that's Absalom's story. It's not really the stuff of fairy tales, right? This is dark, tragic stuff that we can maybe relate to on some levels, and other levels maybe not. But I want to focus on that last verse for a few minutes, and we'll start kind of working our way backwards through the passage, looking first at Absalom's monument and why this is here, and then we'll come back to the main part about his death in just a little bit. But this last verse, I think one of the reasons why I like this, even though it's dark, is it's a type of verse we don't see very often in the Bible. Something that lets us peer into the heart of a deeply troubled man, and even maybe to feel a bit of sorrow for a villain. Again, he's the clear antagonist, and yet there are aspects of this that's like, ooh, this guy bothers me. Justice is being done with his death here because of what he's done, and we can feel good about justice, and that can be good. But at the same time, this is also hard because I kind of get why maybe he had murderous intent towards his half-brother. I mean, isn't he trying just to love his sister? who was raped. Isn't that that kind of, the murder's not justified, but you kind of feel the moral tension, I guess, there as well. So again, in one sense, making a monument and naming it after yourself, you're like, dude, come on. You know, like, that's your, you know, here's a monument, and it's got my name right on it. Have you seen this thing? Let me tell you about it. It's amazing. Oh, and it's named after me. It's the epitome of arrogance, right? Even as a king or the son of a king. And yet, again, it's hard not to relate to the guy when you see how clearly he struggled with insecurity, like we all do. How he feared irrelevance, like we all do, and who is doing everything in his power to try and, I think, kind of elongate his life and legacy. He wants to be remembered, which we kind of often have this, whether we're writing memoirs. It's even almost like a physical thing here of, like, trying to elongate your life with Botox and anti-aging creams. It's not the exact same thing, but that's basically what's going on. He's trying to do something so that death won't completely interrupt a legacy. And so in terms of interpreting this, you can look at it from both of those angles. On the one hand, stealing the throne from your father and setting up a monument in your name is the essence of arrogance. It's the essence of sin. And I think these stories are here so that they become mirrors for us. If you have read the Bible before, this might sound familiar, like when you read Adam and Eve's story in the very beginning, and how the initial sin was basically just this. It was it was claiming independence from God. It was stealing God's throne, or thinking they were. It was saying, I can be like God as well if I just do enough good. I had that within me. I can be like him. That was the devil's lie, and they bit into it. They took the bait, hook, line, and sinker, and sunk their teeth into that lie that we are good enough to be like God on our own. Actually, if you have read the Tower of Babel story in Genesis 11, it's eerily similar to this, where all humanity gathered together and linked arms and teamed up to make this huge tower into the heavens, it says, so kind of the idea of going up to God by what they build. But then it says, let's do this so that we might make a name for ourselves. Very similar to Absalom, that he put his name on the monument, and the people building Babel, the tower, they put their name on it. That the whole point was to make a name for us, for ourselves. And this whole story, again, there's a reason why this is at the very two stories like this, the very beginning of the Bible, and then right here as well, and there are many others, this tower motif. Because the world around us and in our very hearts sing the same tune every day. You just have to, like, turn on the TV or open up social media. You know, things like, look at me, look at us and what we've done. We don't need anyone else. We can do whatever we want if we put our mind to it. Don't let anyone ever tell you you're not the best. Like, things like mantras like this that we get spoon-fed. A lot of times without even realizing it, every day from the world and from our hearts and other sources. If you were to spiritualize it, then you would say, the motif would be, we're pretty good people capable of pretty good things. Like, that's probably what, you know, we're born into that way of thinking. You know, we're bred under that way of thinking. The world certainly, again, spoon feeds us this idea. No one's perfect, but we're pretty good people capable of doing pretty good things, and we might read the Bible or other religious texts or not, just viewing the world, though, and reality kind of through that lens, and we go and live our life and don't maybe think much about it. Well, Absalom's actions, monument building, are with his name on it, are the kinds of stories that God paints over the pages of his book to serve as this mirror to us so we know what kinds of things villains do in the Bible. Villains, it's not just about murder. It's not just about coup attempts. Villains build monuments to themselves. That's what villains, we might not like think like that's the worst thing in the world, but the Bible's like saying this is a pretty big deal because this is an effacement, is that a word, to God. It effaces him. It's an offense. And it's done in our name against his. You can't like have a monument to yourself and a monument to God. Jesus says you can't serve both two masters. And he says that about money, actually, but I think he's actually saying you can't serve yourself and you can't serve God. Like, you can't have two things. It's either God or us. And these stories, then, that he paints them over the pages of his book to shape for us what salvation will be like then as well. And we come to learn in the Bible that salvation, Christian salvation, will fly in the face of stories like this. They will fly in the face of our self-promoting ways, our high view of self ways. The salvation of Christ will come not to flatter or spur us on to really, really, really hard work that looks like building. But instead, it will come against that. It will come to be weak. It will come by way of weakness and humility and grace, all at the hands of another. So on the one hand, you have that way of looking at this monument idea. In another sense, though, you could look at Absalom's monument through the lens of, like, a desire to be remembered isn't altogether bad. It's just that Absalom's taking this to an extreme sinful end. So you could look at it this way. This desire for being remembered is something that Jesus resolves for us as well. Because we come to find out again later in the story that the Christian gospel, when it really encapsulates us or captivates us, we realize, like, it's okay to not be remembered. And that's a struggle. We don't always, like, feel that, of course, but we when we grow in grace, we start to realize that I don't have to be remembered. I don't need a legacy, because we find out how much better life is when it's not about us and when it's about God and his works for us. I heard someone say once that those who don't believe in a bodily, earthly resurrection tend to want to see everything and do everything before they die. Because life's all there is, and time is short. And so that's not an anti-vacation or travel poking, by the way. They're gifts. It's just to say that this sometimes the obsession over bucket lists and things, I think you could say, is not a distinctly Christian attribute. Because for those of us who believe in a resurrection, we know that we have eternity to see it all. And to do it all. We tend to be a bit more relaxed when we are embracing the latter as our ultimate reality. I think it's the same with this idea of remembrance. Absalom is basically trying to elongate his name by his own strength. But for those of us who know God has saved us through his Son, we know that we're seen by him, that we're remembered by him. We forget him all the time, but he never forgets us. He remembers us through his Son. And that's enough. That's sufficient, to use another biblical word. That kind of grace is sufficient for us. No monument needed, just that knowledge that God will always remember us to hell and back. Count Zinzendorf, great name, Moravian Christian from the 1700s, famously said, "Preach the gospel, die, and be forgotten." He was kind of a missiologist before we used that word. He was a missionary, kind of a bishop. Preach the gospel, die, and be forgotten by people. Be forgotten by people. And yes, the irony's not lost on me that he's known for that quote and he's famous for that quote. But still, it's like it's a good. It's actually a really good quote, because Christians, we're far from perfect at this, but we are more jealous for God's name to be remembered than ours. And we know that's good. That's actually not like this sackcloth and ashes, woe is me, life gets worse or harder this way. That's actually an alleviating thing. We don't realize we're weighed down by the need to win as much until we realize, until we're confronted with what the gospel actually is and what God is actually like. And so there's that kind of relief we get, this way. And so we're more jealous for God's name to be remembered, but we also know that he sees us even after we die. And he will help us to endure by grace, to live on, not by our monumental efforts, not by our efforts of religion and good works, but by his Son, who became forgotten for us on the cross, who became a nobody, a nameless no one next to nameless criminal nobodies, thieves, who became that for us so we might be brought in and named and chosen and loved, so we might live forever in his house. And that's super good news. And so so looking at Absalom's life, there's kind of like his monument, there's a cautionary tale, but there's also like a place for empathy, just to say that, you know, we're a lot like him, and God doesn't recoil either. Like, in one sense, he's sinned, and there's justice being done, but in another sense, he is remembering him, and, you know, and so at least we can say that on the side of Christ, that there's a remembrance and a seeing of us that God has. In terms of, like, fully more resolving that idea, though, because, like, even with that idea, that's a little bit nebulous, and we might still ask, well, how does God remember, through what lens? And I've been already saying it a little bit and hinting at it, but I think the passage itself tells us. And for that, we look at the rest of the passage, working backwards, verses 9 to 17. So, Absalom's death. All right. So let me just recap for you how Absalom died, in case you maybe weren't keeping score before, because it's abnormal that's the best word I had, and it was good alliteration, but best word I had for it. It's abnormal, but it's like it needs a better word. It's, to put it mildly, it's just strange. But Absalom was riding a mule, and as he was riding it underneath the thick branches of an oak tree, somehow his hair got caught in it. So let your mind's eye just sort of go wild there in terms of how that worked. Don't totally know. He must have had a great set of hair or something, super thick. But I think what probably happened is the hair got caught, and then just you react. You don't want it to literally pull out of your head, so you do what you can to alleviate the pressure. And so he probably got his hands up there, and then the mule keeps going because the mule is just like, I'm just doing what mules do. I'm just going to keep going. And then he's left hanging there, probably yelling for his mule, but the mule just keeps going. So it's actually, I know it's awful to laugh, but it's hard not to laugh a little bit because it's tragic. But it's comical. It's shameful, actually, for a king. We'll come back to that. But so the mule kept going out from underneath him, and it says actually he was left hanging in, quote, midair. David's three commanders hear about this and they're hesitant to kill him, but Joab is not. Joab, instead of following David's orders to not kill Absalom, he does so anyway. And he thrust three spears into his heart, and they took him and buried him. Okay. Now, let me remind you of a couple of things that we actually say this every week, but not always with this maybe level of summary and teaching. So just to remind, some of you guys are maybe just joining for the first time today, so this will be helpful for you. But two things that you could say have been guiding principles for us interpretationally in this series, and we would say for the Bible itself. So this is not our ideas. These are biblical ideas. But the first is, where there is weirdness or surprises, you'll usually find Jesus in the Bible. Where there's left turns, strangeness, surprises, maybe a gasp-worthy stories. It's actually in those places, the darker corners, is where you usually find these pictures of Christ ahead of time. Second, relatedly and more broadly, as I said earlier, these stories are more prophecy than principle. They're more prophecy than principle. They look ahead more than serve as little moralistic islands that we draw some kind of advice from as readers. They point beyond themselves and defer to Christ symbolically. Peter talked about the magic eye art last week, if you were here for that, is another great image for it. How staring at a story like this and looking through the image, almost, if you've seen those things that pop off the page, it helps. When we do that, when we look through it, almost like the stories are translucent. They're not opaque. If you look closely, you can see through them to an object on the other side, and that object is Christ, usually hanging on that cross. And so when you're able to treat a story like that, it changes everything. But you have to look and expect to see something like you do in the magic art. You have to expect to see something there, or you'll never see it. And so here with Absalom, when we ask that question of how it's serving as that magic art, or how it's serving as a foreshadowing or a breadcrumb of grace, like when we ask the question of how he's pointing beyond himself with his death specifically, maybe it's not too hard to see. I don't know. But let me try to make it even easier for you if it is by summarizing the story this way in a shorter way. A son of David is riding a mule. He gets caught in a tree. He's suspended, quote, between heaven and earth, to quote the ESV. And then he's killed in that tree by being impaled and then buried underneath stones. Okay, so like when you hear that, there's this question that might come up in your brain, like, I feel like I've seen this movie before. I just don't know where, or maybe you do. But like for me, I can only think of two sons of David in the Bible who died in a tree suspended in midair. It's Absalom and it's Jesus. This is almost an exact play-by-play of Jesus' final days and hours, if you think about it. When Jesus, the ultimate son of David, would ride into Jerusalem on a donkey, be pinned to a tree, which is what crosses were called and what they were, and then speared in the side and heart, like Absalom as well, after his death, and then buried in a tomb with a stone rolled in front of it. You can even add in smaller details, like both Absalom and Jesus had people hesitant to kill them. So you have the hesitant ones here with Absalom. Pilate was hesitant with Jesus to kill him. And both Absalom and Jesus had mention of being sold for pieces of silver as well. So tons of non-coincidental details that we simply cannot or should not look away from. Absalom's death is an intentional, symbolic precursor to Jesus' crux, to his cross, to his crucifixion. Two sons of David, two trees, two donkeys, two spears, two pieces of silver, and two hesitations by the ones giving the order or involved with that. Absalom's death is a symbolic precursor to Jesus' crux, and I would go so far to say as it doesn't mean anything, it can't mean anything else apart from that, ultimately. There can be layers to this, of course, and there can be more going on, but nothing, certainly nothing more than this, nothing more than that. Okay, so now, then the question, you guys might be asking this in your mind right now, then the question becomes, well, so what? So what? And if you're asking that question, you're actually asking a really, really good question. Because the first thing we do sometimes with this is we make the connections. The second thing, the other half of the battle, is to ask this question of where's the theology in it? What does it mean? How does God speak to us personally in this and say, this is good news that this is the case? Not just that it's the case, but how is it good news at the same time? That's where we have to get, or else we... Not that the former is a bad thing. These are good things. These are good connections to make because this is what the point is. But we have to get to the why. We have to get to the so what. And I have just a few things here for us in response to that question. All right? The first thing is that these kinds of things make the cross bigger for us. If the timeline is fuzzy for you, remember this happened 1,000 years before Jesus was born. 1,000 years. And crucifixion didn't exist yet, which is why you have Absalom and trees, and it's not a cross yet, or crucifixion, it wasn't invented. And yet God knew that it was coming. He knew that he would send his son to be crucified and to fulfill Absalom's story later. And so you have that shadowy kind of thing, not a one-to-one, but a shadowy thing. But all along, it makes the cross bigger for us. If we're inclined to in any way make the cross a little less a part of the story, yeah, it's a big deal, but there's so much more in the Bible. Yes, it's a big part of it, I realize that, but doesn't God have much more to say than that? When we live our Christian lives, don't we start there but move on to something else? And I think when you see this, like in this random, weird story of the Old Testament, and you see that God was intending Jesus to come and fulfill this, intending the cross to come, it makes it more of a plan A for God. Not an afterthought or plan B, but a plan A in more ways than we'd otherwise tend to think. Like, I look at this story and I think, the cross has the audacity to say, I'm the point of 2 Samuel 18. I'm the point. You may have thought you were, or something, or there was some other lesson. I'm saying that the cross could talk. The cross is saying, I'm the point. That's the audacity here, is not just this story, but every story in the Bible. And so aside from that then, this kind of stuff teaches us how to read the Old Testament, to pull back the veil and read and solve mysteries, basically, because without Christ, what would we do with a story like this? Great questions to ask yourself. Without Christ, where would you go with this story? How would you interpret it? Like, what other, like, landing pad? What other finish line is there? That's good news for you, not bad news. Because, like, what my contention is every other path is going to lead you to bad news somehow. It might not be right away, but every other path you take besides Christ, if it's like primarily you, me, doing something with this, or a cautionary tale or something, is going to lead to some kind of question mark or bad news. And so, again, more symbolic prophecy than Aesop's fables or moral principle to live by. These are the things that teach us how to widen our gaze and see the right thing in these stories. All right, so that in terms of so what, I would say that's the first thing. The second thing is it forecasts the need for someone to be suspended between heaven and earth. In other words, a bridge, a go-between, a mediator between God who's in heaven and sinners who are all the way down on earth. So that physical, spatial, almost this is third-dimensional location of Jesus' death is important. He had to be suspended in air for us to be reconciled with God, who is further up into the air, and to fill the void in between. Irenaeus, who was a second century ancient Christian, who wrote a lot and preached a lot, he commented on this idea. I think it was this passage, but if not, it was this similar idea. But he says, the reason that Jesus died in the air is to defeat the prince of the power of the air, which is what the devil is named elsewhere in the Bible. So Jesus was thrust into the front lines for us. He was thrust into the airspace in between God and us, where the devil ruled. And with his death, he defeated him and nullified all of his accusations against us because he saved us by grace and cleansed us by his blood. So this is why we talk a lot in Romans. The Bible talks a lot about, like in places like Romans, about how it's important for Christians to remember we're no longer under the law, the laws of God, the commandments, because the second we try to live underneath them as though we're obligated to keep them, is the second the devil has weaponry against you to say, you haven't done it perfectly. Now I have something in writing. It's right here. And I can use it against you and accuse you before God for thinking that you had the power to make a monument that was worthy of drawing God's attention, a tower big enough to get into heaven yourself. I have something to accuse you with. But what Paul says in Romans is, Christian, you're no longer under the law. You're under grace. You cannot be under both. You cannot serve two masters. It's either law or grace. It's either living under what you do or living under what God has done. This is like Romans. I just gave you Romans like in a nutshell. That's like, but read the book. It's better. But that's basically it. And so what I love about this imagery, again, is that you have this Jesus going to the place where the devil ruled to quench, satiate, defeat, take the battle to him. And when he did that, when he died in our place for us, and when God said, that's how I'm going to save you, what he's also saying there is, I'm also, by saying that, God is saying, I'm changing the terms. The Old Testament no longer has the final word. My new covenant does. And that was always his plan, to start with a lesser and move to a greater. And that new testament of grace, which is which is made an emblem through the wine and the bread, my son's blood and body, that's the final word, the better word, that nullifies the accuser. All right? More could be said about that. The third, though, is, and this almost goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. It shows us the extreme cost that needed to be paid in order to bring us back from exile. So this is where reading this story in context helps. Absalom's death precedes David's way back into the city of God, just like Jesus' tree death paves our way back into God's very presence, now spiritually and ultimately physically in the new heavens and new earth when it comes down from heaven in the future. So Jesus' death paves our way back from the hopeless desert of this age where we are constantly weighed down by the tragedies of life, by the breakdowns in relationship, by the sins that pour out of our heart, like John Calvin called our hearts an idol factory, and it's constantly producing little things we shouldn't worship, mostly images of ourselves, little monuments with our names on them. But in spite of all of it, from the hopelessness of all of that, a death has occurred to bring us back. That's a phrase from the New Testament, Hebrews, I believe, where it says, a death has occurred that brings us home. A death has occurred that sets into motion the benefits of the will. It's not like if you guys have ever been a beneficiary of a will before. The death of the person that wrote it has to happen before we get stuff, right? Whether it's money or whatever. So in Hebrews, it actually picks up on that and says, well, a death, it's kind of like, salvation's kind of like that. Like a death has occurred, Jesus' death, and because that's happened, benefits go into play for his people, for his church. And what you kind of see here is a prefigurement of that story, that death precedes return. That's the whole story of the Bible. Death, God's son's death, the king's death, precedes the return of people who don't deserve to go back, but get to go back anyway. And so when applied to God, this is some of the beauty of it, when applied to God, the scandal is that it's a cost that God willingly pays for us. It didn't come without a cost for him. And that's maybe the last so what that I'll round this whole thing out with and maybe make my last word here, is salvation is completely out of your hands. Like 2 Samuel 18 is saying salvation is completely out of your hands and mine. Someone else's death makes a way back for you. Not your works, your asceticism, making bloody your knuckles in a religious kind of spiritual way, trying to make something of yourself, to do something that kind of bolsters you, to make yourself savable. None of that. All the story is saying is that someone else's death has occurred. Like David and his people are led back from exile, not because they had time to turn their life around. There's no mention of a certain level of obedience. Like it doesn't say, God's not, okay, you didn't do another Bathsheba fiasco for a year. Well done. You can come back. Right? Like, obviously, that's actually really important to see. There's no sort of balance here that every day you take one off the bad side if you think like you lived a good life or something. David went back undeservedly. He didn't deserve to go back. And yet he did, he got to, as well as his people. That's crucial. And when we see that God wanted to do that in love for us, it adds just another layer of beauty. It's not our death, it's Jesus's. So you are not Absalom. That's the crazy thing. Absalom deserved death because of his sin. We deserve death because of our sin. And yet the point of the story isn't a cautionary tale. It's Jesus saying, this is going to become my story. Even though I'm the perfect son of God, I'm going to become like the villain to make villains my friends. That's the scandal of Christianity. And that's, you know, this story, when you read it, I was thinking this morning, some about this, kind of back to my question about where do you go with this if it's not about Jesus, but like, this story, when you read it, especially at face value, might sound like everything else other than a love story. Like, it's probably not the first thing you think of when you read this story. Like, oh, that's romantic. You know? It's like, no, it's not. It's like, you'd call it a cautionary tale. You'd call it rote history. You'd call it justice is done. You know? You'd maybe just call it, if you like the story, like kind of interesting or intriguing. That's where you'd go with it, right? But actually, because this is about Jesus, this is actually exactly what it is. This is a love story. This story is about love because God is saying, this is how much I love you. I'm going to come into the world and die in a tree to destroy the devil's wall between me and you. That's pretty romantic. God is saying, I love you so much, I'm going to take the bullets. I'm going to take the hits. I'm not going to come into the world and say, try to be a better person than Absalom so this fate doesn't happen to you. That's not how he talks to people in the Gospels, right? He doesn't talk that way. He says, you already have done Absalom things. What I'm saying is I'm coming to you on the terms of grace, not on the basis of the law anymore. I'm saving people who shouldn't be saved. I'm declaring my enemies my friends, and the way I do that is by shedding my blood for them, to win them back, to die in their place for their sins, and those who believe in me become my people, become my church. And so that's what this is. That's that final twist of the diamond I'll leave you guys with, is, and I encourage you not just to hear the concept, but hear the very voice of God call out to you, saying, this is how much I love you. I love you so much that I sent my son to fulfill this story for you and to wrap it around himself, to absolve it, to resolve it, to fix it, to be an answer to it, to solve the mystery of it, and to fulfill it, to complete it for you, so that you, weak and weary sinner, can have a home and can come back from the desert of this age and the hopelessness of our sin. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this passage and for what it means to us. It is fair to say, I think, that without you, these stories would remain impossible to understand, like impossible. And yet, because you came into the world and in the New Testament are called the mystery revealer, the secret revealer, in part, that means your word. The secrets of the Old Testament are made known, the mysteries, the unsolved mysteries of the strange narratives of the Old Testament are made plain. They're laid bare. They make sense now because of the one who came to be the final and better version of all of it. And again, there's so much to thank you for, but we thank you for not recoiling at our sin and our brokenness, but coming all the way down to become the Son of David. That is a loaded title, because that means you came to become like Absalom. You came to become like David's sons, who are not all that great. Though you are perfect, you took on the role of a villain to die as a substitute, so we might be looked on with favor and acceptance and love. Help us to believe and trust in you and be distinctly Christian in how simple we make our faith along those lines. In your name we pray. Amen.